You have found the Business Broker Growth Show with your host, Jason Cutter. This is the podcast for brokers who are ready to stop hoping for deals and start growing their pipeline. Our goal is to bring you strategies, stories, and insights that will be a catalyst to move you quickly from transactional deal makers to trusted advisors. Time for Business Broker Growth.
Hey everybody, Jason here, back with another episode of the Business Broker Growth Show. Today I have with me Jessica Craig. She is the founder of Exit Well. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited as well. You now mark the second Canadian business broker to be on the show. And so I'm excited because it's fascinating how similar but also different it is. And then you have a very uniquely different situation with where you live and then your market and all of that. But for the people at home, just a brief intro, and then, you know, I want to dive into that with you. So you founded Exit Well, so Certified Business Intermediary. And then I also, if I have this right, you are the current president of the IBBA Canada. Is that correct?
I am, yes. We are the Canadian chapter of IBBA.
That's amazing. I love it. And we'll dive into that as well. And so you focus on helping the clients transition with clarity, confidence, and maximum value. And you started this as your brokerage company. So let's dive in. Let's talk about that. And for people who are tuning in, where do you live? And let's talk about the size of your market before we then get into that stuff.
Yeah, so I'm based in Victoria in the province of BC. So we are on Vancouver Island. We are separate from kind of the main hub of BC, which is Vancouver, where most people know. The island's fairly big, like landmass wise, it's huge, but there's not a huge amount of people, right? Significantly less people on Vancouver Island than there is like just in Vancouver. So it is a smaller market, but it is, you know, it's a beautiful place to live. We're on the West Coast, oceans, mountains. It's incredible. We're pretty lucky.
Yeah. But since you're on an island, obviously there's a certain number of businesses on the island, but you're probably doing more within the BC province, which means what, a lot of ferry time, a lot of virtual meetings?
Yeah, lots of virtual meetings. I do take the ferry quite a bit back and forth. You can fly also, which is a little bit more convenient, but it is nice to be able to access businesses in other parts of the world. Like I do help people across Canada if they need that. But the bulk of my clients are over here on Vancouver Island.
Got it. Okay. So let's talk about how you started. So you were actually working for a bank at one point as a small business advisor, and then went into the mergers and acquisitions world. What was that transition like? What led to that?
I was working in banking kind of fresh out of my MBA, and I had so much energy to, you know, get in there and start making a difference. I don't know. And banking it just felt like that was not for me. It was very, I don't know, anybody who's worked in banking, I think you either love it or you just really don't love it. And that's fair. Some people really love the structure and how it works. It just really wasn't for me. I was very much like entrepreneurial minded. I wanted to make changes and do things. And they were always like, nope, can't do that. Can't do that. Okay. I'm struggling. So I moved on and I found actually a firm out of Vancouver that was looking for someone on Vancouver Island. And that was where I started. And it was awesome. I had really amazing training through them. There was a great team there. And I really enjoyed kind of learning as I went, how the whole, you know, business brokerage process went, doing my first, you know, M&A transactions and all of that with that team. It was really amazing. And then I decided to leave just last year to start Exit Well because I wanted to focus more on exit planning into business brokerage. It's a little bit of a different model and I really focus on kind of education first.
All right, so let's talk about it's funny, I was making some notes here, the banking world, you either love it or you don't love it. And I could see that challenge when you're entrepreneurial, you want to do things, you want to, you know, grow or change. And that's not what banking does or is known for.
Not really.
Right? No. No, it's not in their business model to change and revolutionize. It takes a lot. Like, you know, I think that's where a lot of fintech startups gain a lot of ground, because they're innovating, they're creating technology, yeah. they're changing things up in ways that banks literally don't have a mode for. Is that accurate?
I would think so. Yeah. There's, you know, they're doing all sorts of things that you wouldn't be able to do in a traditional bank. And I think sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. You know, there's lots of things that banks are good for. me being there was not one of them.
Well, and you think about it, like, it's also good that they're not innovating and constantly changing, because you need a bank, like you said, to do the things that banks do well, and keeping money safe and being smart as an industry, that's probably more important than taking chances.
Yeah.
Okay. So you, like you said, you went and worked for business brokerage, M&A intermediary. And then let's talk about what you said. You kind of, you glanced over, but I know it's a big thing for you, is that the exit planning became an important part for you. And so exit planning means what in your mind?
Yeah. So exit planning is more the kind of preparation before you get ready to sell your company. So I went through the process and I got my CEPA, my Certified Exit Planning Advisor. And I did that because I wanted to start kind of adding that into what I offered through ExitWell. So we start actually quite a bit earlier. And depending on what the clients need, you can either do, you know, like lots of exit planners do full-on consulting year on year before they get ready to sell. I do a little bit more like lighter touch point, but still earlier touch point. So I'm working with them in kind of a lighter capacity, I would say, but year on year before we actually get ready to do the sale, so that when it comes time, we've already built that relationship. We know that the company's in good shape, and then we're much better prepared to do the transaction. So far, you know, because I'm fairly new, so far I'm still doing a lot of that exit planning right now. I'm still doing that with my clients. And then eventually we'll get to the point where we do more of the transactions. But I still help people who are ready to sell now, and we do their transaction immediately if needed.
Got it. So, and then the business model is there's a fee for this exit planning. You're doing the light touch version. Obviously there's others that are doing way more consulting and getting in there. But so they're paying that fee, and then at some point getting to a level where the exit's going to happen either at a higher valuation or even just smoothly and at all. Is that the goal?
Yeah, that's kind of the idea. And it depends on where they're at when we started, right? If they're in a place where you can grow the value, great. We spend some time and we build it up and build that value to whatever we want it to be before we put it on the market. Or they might be in the place where the business is not really sellable at all when we start. You know, maybe it's kind of one owner and, you know, contractors or something, and it's like all really dependent on that person. So we kind of work to bring them out of it and build something that we can actually sell a few years ago.
How often throughout all the exit planning you're officially doing now and or what you've seen before, where a company is just not sellable? Like, it's not, or like, I guess because I've learned this from brokers as well, is that it's not that a company is not sellable. It's that it's not going to get the price that somebody is wanting as a asset.
Yeah. That's probably what we see more often. Occasionally you will find ones that probably aren't sellable. They're either
not at all.
Small, just like, you know, a solo something. Like, occasionally you'll see that. But a lot of the time you'll see someone who has kind of an idea of what it's worth, and then it ends up not being worth that for whatever reason. And then they're in a place where they're like, okay, do I sell for this lower amount, or do I keep it and I try to grow it to get it to where I thought it should be in the first place? And that's kind of where we come in, where we can help them make that decision and know what they need to do to get it to that level if they want to.
How do you approach that conversation? Because in my mind, whenever I've heard that as something that would be discussed, so somebody's got a price in mind that's like not even going to happen, or that's not it, the market isn't going to match up based on the dynamics of business, is you're having this conversation with this business owner who's got this number in mind, Like, how do you handle that conversation in a way that doesn't upset them? I don't know all the outcomes could come, but like, just imagine that person, A, they're not used to people telling them no, or that they can't do something. And then B, they wanted a number. Now you're saying like, that's not probably.
Delicately, I guess, is how I would. I think it depends on the person, like depends on the business owner. Some are really receptive, like they just want the information that you can provide, and others are really like you know, they get their hackles up, they're really upset, you know, that's the truth of it. They really are, you know, disappointed in what you have to say. So it's kind of like knowing who they are in the conversations that you've had so far and approaching it in a way that you think would make sense for that person, whether you're just kind of straight up with it or, you know, you kind of more ease into it. But everybody's different, and it's always going to be disappointing to in some way, you know? When they had an idea and you're not going to meet that expectation, there's always that like level of disappointment. So it's just like trying to approach it in a way that it's not personal, and we're not like, you know, we're not saying that you personally didn't do a good job. You know, the businesses are always like, they're successful, they're profitable, there's great things about them. It just maybe isn't worth on the market what you had thought. And so we're trying to approach that in a way that we can share what's great about it and also what doesn't meet their expectation.
Yeah. And I know it's not the ideal comparison, but I think of, you know, somebody who lives in a home, maybe has remodeled their home a bunch. Their house has been their home for their family. They raise their kids. Yeah. They have this emotional attachment. They think it should be worth a ton because they've remodeled it. And it's like, yeah, but the market doesn't see it that same way, right? Like the market isn't lined up with your emotional value of your house or what you think. I can imagine that discussion can be tough. I think it depends too. As I'm listening to you talk, I think it also depends, like you said, about where they're at in the process. Are they starting it and they're looking at this and trying to learn, then set up a plan moving forward? Or are they at the like, here's what I want. I want to sell. I want to get out of this business, you know, tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. And then that's why, you know, we tried to shift into this kind of exit planning model so that we can have that conversation a few years before they're ready. So that if I have to disappoint them, I can at least give them like a future, potential future that is maybe better or closer to what they wanted. That's the hope. When we get those calls where they have to sell right away, or, you know, they're at a year or they want to sell, you know, very, very soon, then you just don't have that opportunity to help them grow it to the place where they want it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Then that makes it tough, right? Because then it is what it is. It's selling as it is, if there's not going to be any effort into changing it. Yeah. So how do you, and I know that you're figuring this out on this journey. I know that from this aspect, I don't know if anyone's really got a good handle on it, but how do you get to those business owners early enough so that it's exit planning and not, you know, I don't want to say fire sale, but like you're selling under less than ideal condition.
Yeah, I think like you said, I am still figuring it out, because a lot of brokers that I talk to, we have the kind of the same issue. We're trying to get people early on, but they don't really have that pain point yet, right? The pain point comes when they're ready to sell. And so when you're trying to market to them, or you're trying to approach them from a place of like explaining to them that the exit planning is important, it's tricky. It's not something that's necessarily top of mind. So I'm just trying a bunch of different things right now where we kind of test what works, what kind of, you know, what kind of approaches actually make sense to people, and what gets people to inquire now versus later. One of the things we're trying is a course. So like fairly low commitment, so that they can just come in and like learn for a short period of time, maybe some things that they don't know about selling. And then hopefully using that, it will trigger some things that will be like, okay, I should do this earlier rather than later because of all of these things I just learned. But it's not, you know, it doesn't have that high barrier or anything like that, that I think sometimes dissuades people from going straight for that M&A broker.
Yeah. And part of me thinks about what you and I have spoken in the past, which is a dynamic with Canada versus the US, is that you guys don't have SBA lending, right? And so because of that, financing's not really a thing, which means, like you told me, that there's less deals, there's less transactions going on, and there's the potential that there's more maybe businesses that close than actually transact, right? Because they don't actually have a buyer. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't have data necessarily to say the difference between the US and Canada on that, but I would assume just population alone that we have less kind of transacting on the day to day. And sometimes for us, especially the smaller deals, it's harder to get lending for. From what I know of SBA lending, those smaller deals, I think, fit into the SBA model quite well. And here we have more struggles if there's no tangible assets, if we're trying to lend just on the goodwill, we really have, I think, fewer options that really fit that model. So I think for us, we see less of the smaller transactions happening at the level that you guys have.
And then, you know, thinking about that as the pain point, especially as businesses, you know, aren't thinking about selling or don't think they have something they need to plan ahead for. It's similar. And it's interesting because think about it, like as an employees, most people are trained, like think about retiring planning, put money into a 401k or something like that, build up a pension or retirement so that you have that. Business owners are like, I have this business, I'm in this business. They're not even thinking about selling. They're not thinking in the long term. They're just doing the business, right? And then how do you break into that and say, you should really be thinking about it? Like at some point, there will be an exit, whether you like it or not.
Yeah, exactly. It's 100% of business owners are going to exit their business.
100%. Any business owners listening now, if you're like, I'm never going to exit, you will exit the business one way or another.
That's how it goes. But it is tricky to get that, you know, concept when you are in the business day to day. You know, you work in it every day. And for a lot of people, that is their main retirement. Like the value that they've built in this company is what's going to sustain them after they retire, or what's going to pass on to their families if something should happen to them. And I think that's the one that usually has the most ramifications, right? If something happens to a business owner and their family is left either trying to sell that company or trying to run that company, and they don't have the systems and the processes in place to help keep it going, then they lose a lot of that value that they built over time, which could then help their family, you know, pay for whatever they need to pay for, or, you know, have inheritance, whatever you want to leave behind, right? However that looks for your circumstance.
Yeah. And to your point, it's really about getting out there and educating as many as possible. It's part of, like, any longtime listeners of this podcast know that many times I end the show focused on that, where it's about getting this kind of information out there, because it's just not a thing. It's not an understood dynamic like other things are. Like if you want to go buy a house and you go to a lender, there's kind of an understood thing. Or if you talk to enough people who bought houses, they can walk you through every step. That's not the same thing with exiting businesses and dealing with a business broker and exit planning. And so the more that you can get this kind of content out there, I think is important, because at some point it'll get to a level where people realize or know what they don't know, and then they can start planning.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's the big thing, right? It's getting it out there just in broadly in general, just having more people know about it and getting it more well known. Most of the people that I talk to don't know what business brokers are, or they think that we are realtors or something like that. And we're not. It's very different. It's a very different process. You're not just gonna be able to call me and sell your business when you want to for for the amount that you want to, like we've done.
Yeah. And on that note, I know one of the things you mentioned to me when we spoke too, is that there's, you know, residential commercial agents, realtors, who think they can sell a business. And I know that happens in the US as well, because it kind of falls under the same thing where 17 states in the US, you have to have a real estate license, which is not comparable, doesn't help you with any part of that process. Where do you see that happening in Canada as well?
We see that a lot as well. It's really? Very similar. Some provinces you are required to have a real estate license, some you are not. And same thing, both commercial and residential realtors sometimes tackle business sales, but having done my residential or commercial real estate license, I didn't learn any of the things that I needed. I was like, great, now I know a whole bunch of other stuff, but none of it was like actual business sale. And I have heard, at least in BC, that they are changing some of the curriculum maybe to bring that in, which could be interesting, but for the most part, it's just so different. And I think that we do a disservice to clients when we approach things that we don't fully understand, you know, like I don't know how to sell a house. I'm not going to go try and do that. You know, I'm going to stick in my, like in my area of expertise and do things that I know how to do. And I think that's similar for real estate. There are some realtors who do like focus on business sales and they're members of the IBBA, they have their CBIs, then I think that they are doing the right things, right? They're learning how to provide the service that they provide and they're doing it the right way. But not everyone does that.
Yeah, that's tough. And I would be interested to see what happens as a result if BC adds business sale curriculum to the real estate license. I feel like that's a dangerous slippery slope that then gives residential real estate agents permission to get involved with business sales. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I honestly don't know much about it. I've just heard it in passing. So I could be wrong. Maybe they're not planning to add that at all. But I think that like anything, it will start off probably not very good and need to be developed. Yeah. You know, it will like, instead of doing that, they could just send everybody to the IBBA and actually get the education that they built. But
yeah. Yeah. Well, and I know for myself, I got my real estate license years ago when I was still living in Washington State to help with some transactions, was dealing with people in foreclosure and things like that. And at certain times, some people, you know, just wanted help selling. And I was like, okay, let me get my license. And still had to basically sign up with a brokerage and have a mentor and somebody who shared commission on a certain number of deals. It was like, yes, I understand real estate, but that doesn't mean I know what to do in that process. Right. So think about that. And then think about, you know, how many transactions does it take for a business broker to be able to do a transaction successfully. Right.
Yeah.
And be able to look around corners and go, okay, I know what's coming next. Let's get ahead of it.
Yeah, I think it's very similar in Canada. I think that's similar for the industry in general, like working with an advisor or a firm that has all of that experience, that's where you're going to gain the bulk of it. And when you work for a real estate firm, you're not getting that same support or education. So it's not going to work.
No. So let's talk about the IBBA for a second, since kind of brought that up. What is that like with being in the Canadian chapter, right? So you have the Canadian chapter, which is all of Canada, right? Is it one chapter across there, or is it by
one province? Chapter, the whole country.
Okay. And then we have the US. It's technically IBBA, which is the international, right? So it's everybody, but it's kind of housed in the US. It's based in the US. You know, what is that like for you as a Canadian chapter? Where is it valuable? Where is it still kind of separate?
Yeah, I think for us, it's really valuable to be connected to the larger group. I don't know the full numbers off the top of my head, but I think IBBA total is like over 3,000 members. It's huge. And IBBA Canada, we're at about 130 right now. And so we're a super small portion of the whole network. So I think it's great for us to be connected to that and be able to get access to the resources that you can build when you have a 3,000 person organization versus 130 person, right? So yeah. I think that's really helpful for us. Like we can go to their conferences and we can do all of the education that they offer, which is so much more robust than we can offer ourselves. And it's like, they've been doing it for such a long time. Their education programs are really good. So it gives us access, obviously, to learn and grow through that. And then because we're separate, we can also offer additional things. Like we do our own Canadian conference every other year. We're working on some Canadian specific course content that people can take. And then we offer those obviously back to the greater group if they want to participate in them. But then we have something that's, you know, Canadian specific. So it gives us a little bit of both, I think.
Yeah, it's fascinating, especially to think of that percentage wise, a small group. And then, but if you think of geography wise, that's a small number of members spread over a large physical area. But I know from speaking with you and some other brokers from Canada is that what's also fascinating is that Canada basically or around represents 10% of the business opportunities and transactions that you would have in the US, right? So there's also just a smaller kind of supply and demand of the businesses that are transacting every year. Is that correct?
I would assume so. To be honest, I don't know the data. I haven't checked it out, but I would assume yes. It's just based on, you know, population and what's going on in our respective countries. We're just smaller.
Yeah. All right. So before we move on, I want to go back to the exit planning side, which is obviously what you do. You help people exit well. It's in the company name, which I love. What are some of the, like, if you had to name a few top things, areas that a business owner usually, I'm trying to think, I don't want to say get in trouble, but the kind of things that keep them from exiting now or the things that they would start working on now for the future? What are those main categories that just jump out to you?
The biggest one I think that we see is owner dependence. So when the owner is either the face of the business or they're in the business, you know, they work 50, 60 hours a week and every decision needs to come through them. They're kind of the main bottleneck. They can't go on vacation. That's definitely the biggest one because presumably they're burnt out by the time they're ready to sell and they want to get out of there. But then it's like, hey, who's going to take on those tasks? Who's going to train the new owner on how to do those tasks? And then that then leads to either things like seller notes or earnouts or long training and transition plans, which sellers never want any of those things.
Yeah. Especially if they're burnt out, right? They just want to be done. And then the challenge is too, is that in that scenario where the business is owner dependent, then that new owner short term is buying themselves a job. Yeah. Okay. So that's the number one. So the biggest one is owner dependence. What else do you see?
Another one is definitely in the financials and how clean they are. And it's not that most buyers are expecting perfection and they're not looking at it the way for us, it's the CRA or whatever your tax, you know, position would be. The CRA is looking at it in a different way than a buyer is, but you do need to be able to clearly articulate what has happened, right? If you have any discretionary expenses, can you prove them or show records of them or that sort of thing? Or, you know, do you track which clients bring in the most amount of money? Do you track, you know, your inventory accurately? So those sorts of things where a lot of people maybe don't necessarily track them because the money's coming in. And so it doesn't really seem like an issue. I think that's what I see the most. They're like, no, business is good. The money's in, money's out. Like it all moves smoothly. But then when it comes time for a buyer to look at it, they don't understand where that money came from, how much of it is tied to the owner, and how much is going to be predictable long-term.
Before a seller ever speaks to you, they look you up. They scan your name, they search your LinkedIn, they read your last few posts, and in about 60 seconds, they decide whether you feel like a trusted advisor or just another broker. Most brokers never see that moment, but it happens every day. That's why we built the Digital Impact Assessment. It's a structured evaluation of how your online presence actually shows up in four ways: authority, positioning, visibility, and engagement. And if you want to know what sellers are seeing before they book a call with you, just remember you can't improve what you don't measure. All right, now back to this amazing conversation.
And how much is going to be predictable long-term?
Probably. Yeah. And being able to tell that story of what happened, what's happening, right? Because there's most of the time, I would assume some kind of good explanation for what's going on.
If you're listening to this and thinking, I need this level of authority, I just don't have time to build it, that's exactly what Business Broker Growth does for you. Most brokers know that they need consistent content, better positioning, and real digital visibility. They just don't have the bandwidth to create it or the systems to keep it going. That's what we do here. We build that whole thing for you. The content engine, the visibility strategy, and the authority signals, everything we've talked about here on the podcast. So if you want to add impact without adding another full-time job to your plate, go to businessbrokergrowth.com to learn more about what it could look like for your business.
Yeah. And being able to tell that story of what happened, what's happening, right? Because there's most of the time, I would assume some kind of good explanation for what's going on if it's tracked and if it's documented. The question is it? Or is it a big mystery? And then it feels like a really weird story.
Yeah.
If it's exactly not being tracked.
Yeah. It's like, I can see what happened for the most part. You know, I can look at your financials. But then if we ask questions or the buyer asks us questions, we don't know how to answer them because there was no data. So that's definitely a big challenge.
How much do you see, I'm feeling there's probably some other exit kind of readiness points too, but how often do you see or feel like a buyer is going to look at a business that might be available? The financials are a mess, or there's lots of questions they can't answer, or things kind of feel in disarray or whatever. And the buyer looks at it and goes, if this is a mess, what else am I going to uncover if I were to buy this? Like, is this just the tip of the iceberg of kind of the chaos?
Yeah, absolutely. That's usually one of the things that flags them to look deeper at other things that they sometimes wouldn't necessarily look as deep into. You know, if everything is a mess, then it suggests that other things might not be tracked also, or like your processes and operations are a bit messy or things like that. Like that, it all kind of leads into the same thing. And then buyers want more, not justification, but more, you know, more data to support what asking price is, because the financials are not clear. So they, you know, now they want to see your operating procedures. They want to dig into everything deeper to make sure that there's nothing else that's like messy.
I mean, if we really look at humans, there's a bunch of truth to two different sayings and modes. One is how we do small things is how we do big things, and how we do some things is how we do everything, right? Like, it might not always be the case, but at some fundamental level, somebody's either organized and tracking things or is not. Somebody is a ready, aim, fire, or they're a, you know, fire, fire, aim, fire, fire, ready, fire, 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 like, you know, that kind of mode. So there's some aspect where that's generally true. And if you understand that, or if you're aware of that, you can really learn a lot from like what somebody's showing you, and then assume what else is there that they're not showing you.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. What else? Is there any other exit readiness hotspots?
Yeah. Another one I would say is structure. So especially for Canadian companies, there are certain tax structures that you might need if you want to take advantage of your lifetime capital gains exemption. And that can be like, you can get a lot of money tax-free on the sale of your business, because that qualifies if your business meets these certain structural metrics. So you have to be incorporated. You have to make sure there's no excess cash in the company, which is usually the biggest one. And then if you have multiple owners, like they can all qualify. So maybe you would want to add your spouse onto the company before you sell. So there's all these structural things that can benefit you from a tax perspective when you get ready to sell your company, but you usually need at least 2 years in order to do almost all of them. So if you're getting ready to sell now and you don't have your structure in place, then, you know, same thing with everything else, right? It's going to be the value that it's at today, and it's the structure that it's at today, and you can't make the changes that could benefit you from a tax perspective.
And hearing you talk about that with that lifetime capital gains exemption, you could still get the price today that you're thinking, but it's just going to mean a much bigger, different net to you.
Yeah, exactly. That just completely changes your taxable income on that sale.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting. Well, hopefully you can keep getting to business owners early in the process to help them with these three things, because they all, like the owner dependency, that's the toughest one when I look at this list and I think about it, because that can be tough for some owners who are the founder, they're the chief widget maker and or controller and runner of things, right? It's tough for them to transition into a business owner from basically a founder. Financial structure, that seems straightforward.
Yeah.
So hopefully you can keep getting to them early and early in the process.
Hopefully, yeah. That's the goal.
All right. Well, that's a good transition. Let's talk about the next part, which is the broker growth section. So this is talking about like not just marketing tips, but also your growth, what you found when you were doing M&A intermediary business brokerage for the previous firm, and then now as you're growing yours with more of the exit planning kind of long-term focus with this, with the clients as well, mixed with the brokerage. So what have you found so far? What are you focusing on? Where are you putting your effort into growing your pipeline?
Yeah, I think for me, one of the biggest things that I've worked on, you know, previous to starting ExitWell and now, is to build a referral network of people in adjacent areas. I get a lot of referrals from wealth planners. They're like amazing to work with. Lawyers sometimes, accountants often, you know, different groups who are doing similar work, but different, obviously. And then also building networks with people who do larger transactions than I do. So if they're, you know, like MNP has been a good one for me. They're taking on transactions that are larger. You know, there might be some crossover for the types of transactions that we would do, but for the most part, they're going to work with bigger companies. And then when somebody smaller comes along, they need somebody to shoot that off to, because it's not going to fit their, you know, their model. So that's also a really good one.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a good approach. You know, one thing I always suggest to people is, whose clients are your clients? So thinking of the wealth planners, the attorneys, CPAs, you know, those people in that sphere where their clients are also your clients when that intersection comes, when they need your help. And then there's who out there is their disqualified clients, right? They're either too big or too small or not the right fit, but perfect for you. Or they're ready eventually, but they're not ready now and they need help, right? Where does that fit in? And potentially maybe those realtors out there who realize I shouldn't be selling businesses.
Yeah. Yeah.
I should leave it up to Jessica. Let me just get them over to Jessica so that she can help.
Send them to me. I'll be happy to take them.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay. So first one's referral network, which I think is always valuable. Downside with the referral network though is A, it's inconsistent. You never know when you're going to get a referral. And then that's the long game, right? It takes a long
time.
Once it kicks off, like once you have a strong referral network, then it's great, because then you probably get too busy. Like I've seen enough businesses and you know, service professionals where they get too busy because it's working so well. But until then, what else is on your list?
Yeah. Growing? Yeah, definitely the referral network is the long game for sure. another one that I've found really helpful for me personally, because I'm really focused on the education aspect of it, is speaking opportunities. So I teach courses for a couple of nonprofit groups, and then it gets you in front of their entire network, right? So one of the groups I've worked with is, it's called WeVC, but it's a Women's Entrepreneurial Network in British Columbia. And my first kind of talk that I did with them, which was around business sale, I had 120 women that wanted to learn about it. So it just gets you in front of way more people really quickly. Like I ExitWell would never have reached 120 women when it first started, you know, but using their networks, it gets you in front of a lot of people really quickly if you can kind of build those avenues. So I do that quite a bit, like just general speaking, any sort of speaking engagement that I can get, I will do. And then lots of like I teach courses and work with nonprofits and things like that too, to educate their people. And that's been a really big driver for me.
Yeah. And I love that. I think it's a great way to essentially leverage somebody else's audience or network, right? Like you said, getting 120 women, business owners, entrepreneurs, or people who are thinking about that into your network is hard to do for your own entity, right? But showing up at an event that somebody else has already gotten this community together, or this audience, or people who are going to come to this conference or event, then that's easy, because then you can kind of ride the coattails of what they've built, come in as the expert, and then build lots of value for them without having built the network. And so I think that's a great tip to people out there, is where can you speak? Where can you give back? What kind of organizations can you be a part of? Where it's adjacent, it's also experience that you can get. I think that's where, you know, joint webinars are valuable too. Where can you do a webinar with somebody who they've got the audience, you've got the expertise. And then I think what's great is I'm hearing you talk, and I've come to get to know you well enough to know that you're about educating and teaching and courses and speaking and all of that stuff, versus going in there and doing a sales pitch about, you know, ExitWell and you, right? So I just imagine you being there, and then you're just teaching them, like, here's the things to think about, here's what you need to know, educate first, bring value, and then see where it goes from there.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's got to be education first. Nobody wants to see you take the stage and just pitch yourself and your company. And that's, I mean, maybe you get some business out of that, but that's not, definitely not the way that I approach it. I really think it's important to give back and help educate people. And then that will come back to you. Similarly to your referral network, it is also a bit of a long game, right? You might get, you know, I got some great feedback immediately, but then I also get, like, you know, residual people who come later on and be like, oh, I saw you do this talk, you know, 8 months ago. I was like, wow, that's pretty cool. You know, so you still get those, like, kind of tail things coming on down the line as well.
Especially with the type of clientele that you work with, it is the long game, right? Because whether they sell, if they say, I want to sell now, and they have a sellable business, you're still in it for 9 to 12 months, maybe sooner. There's some transactions I know will happen faster, for people who are triggered and go, I can close mine. And, like, yes, I get it. Like, there's ones that can close sooner, and then there's ones that take longer, and then there's ones that take years, and ones that never close. So, like, it's still always that mode. So you just got to get good at that long term. I think also another thing that just, it makes me think of it, and I just want to throw this out there too. One of the things for anyone listening to this that's valuable in speaking and doing those volunteering things, you're not getting paid, you're going here, you yourself, you're having to pay a bunch of money and spend a lot of time to even get to an event like that. Like, if anyone wants to look on the map, Vancouver Island versus Vancouver, it's not, you know, just hop in the car and you're just getting there, right? And so, but going to those events, doing those things, doing the webinars, doing the speaking training, you know, doing you know, courses and all that stuff, it's also a really good way to get really good at what you're talking about. And then based on the audience feedback, learning what resonates, so you can just get better and better at your part of helping people. It's a really good way to practice and kind of work out, like, what do people care about and what do people not care about, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the best way to learn something is to try to teach it, right?
That too. Yeah, it's so true. And then, you know, it's also interesting because when you know a lot of stuff, right, you've done the courses, you've got the certifications, you know these things, it's tough sometimes, because for people like us, when you know a lot about something, you get on stage and you want to teach it, and people are just like, yeah, but I don't care about that stuff, here's what I care about. You're like, oh, okay, just because I know this doesn't mean this is what we have to talk about. Like, let's talk about what people actually want to learn about, like, what's applicable to them, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what, yeah, like you were saying, what resonates with them, what actually, like, you know, all of the jargon or whatever you're saying. And they're like, I don't understand any of that. You're gonna have to break this down. And then I'm like, okay, next time I teach this, I'm going to teach it differently.
Which is where some of like the hardcore professional technicians, these are my labels for them. So think of like a CPA, they get in front of a group. And if they're not careful, they're going to go into CPA talk and talk about really technical things that an audience may not care about or may not want to hear about first. Like it just, you know, should evolve into that. So I think it's great. I love that you're getting out there and doing the speaking. What else? What else on your list? We got referral network, long game, speaking, long game.
Lots of long game. I mean, if you're thinking of the things that I have found that are the fastest, which are my least favorite thing, it's cold calling. I hate it. Yes. I feel like lots of people hate it. I don't know. But if we're thinking about the thing that actually works the fastest for me, it's getting on the phone and actually reaching out to people. Again, you have to it's a bit of a numbers game. You know, you have to keep calling and get a lot of no's and get a lot of people who aren't interested, but you're more likely to get somebody who is in a place where they're ready to move forward quickly. If that's something that you're trying to do, cold calling.
Got it. Okay. anything else on the list?
I think for me, marketing has also been really helpful. Just building out my marketing platform and being consistent with it. I am not a big social media person. It's not like I don't use it personally, really. I have a LinkedIn and that's kind of where the bulk of my social media time goes. But being consistent with it and constantly getting out there, especially for someone like me, who's trying to do this like education forward type of marketing, I think it's important to be using those platforms. So being consistent in your marketing and your message and getting out there on the various platforms, I think is helpful. I recently hired somebody to help me because it's like I said, I don't use it personally. I'm like, I don't know. I feel like I'm like a million years old. I'm like, how do I make a Facebook post?
Yeah, you're also not a million years old. So it's funny because you're like, yeah, I just don't do it. I don't know it.
I don't know. I don't understand. So I've hired somebody to help me.
Good. That's good, right? Like that, I think that's important. And I think that the marketing and it's one of those things, also the long game, but where you put that content out there, the educational content, especially like I love you, your phrase, education forward kind of content. You know, it's one of the biggest things we see with the brokers that we work with. It's like, how do you just put that out there? You just build this trusted authority kind of bubble around you so that when anyone gets close, they realize like, okay, you know what you're talking about. You can help this kind of person with this kind of scenario. This is who you provide the most value for. And it's tough because you just got to do that over and over again, right? It's like, you know, working out or wanting to be healthy. You're not going to see results for quite some time. You just got to keep doing it over and over again.
Yeah. The consistency is the key there. You got to keep going and, you know, you're not going to get anything out of the first post or the first couple of posts or however long it takes you to get it going. Yeah. But if I go and do a speaking opportunity and then somebody comes to look for me online and they can't find anything, you know, that's where I was having trouble before. It was, you fall out of touch. Whereas if they can find you right away and they follow you on any of the platforms, then you're there in their feed all the time. The people who use social media, not me.
Yeah. And it is an interesting thing because I deal with people all the time who are like, well, I don't know if that stuff matters. And my buyers, you know, or my sellers, my clients aren't on LinkedIn or they aren't here, but at some point they're going to look, they're going to search, they're going to see, is there enough data points that validate something else they heard about you or from you or whatever and say, okay, yes, this does line up. Going back to what we talked about the business owners, right? Like how we do some things, how we do everything. It's like, if you sound good over here, but then you're non-existent everywhere else, it's like, okay. Now, again, I joke all the time. People have sold things for millions of years without a website and without social media and without a podcast, right? However, in this day and age, that takes a lot of work to be an effective professional without any digital presence or even a massive amount of digital presence.
Yeah. And I think, you've got to find what works for you, right? If you're just like amazing at cold calling and that's all you want to do, then maybe that's all you need to do. But
there you go.
Find what works.
good job. Don't call me though. You can do that. I don't know if that's what the world needs, but good job. I love it. I think it's, you know, I think that's, it's very correct, right? It's like, stick to what works for you. I think that's what's always important too. It's like, what's good for you? It's what I tell people all the time. Some people are like, well, I'm not a good writer. It's like, well, then do video. Oh, and then other people be like, well, I don't like doing videos. It's like, okay, then write. Like, you don't have to be amazing at everything. Just do something really well. And then there's enough technology out there to make other things. Like, there's enough videos out there you can see where somebody's face isn't on it. Maybe it's audio only. Maybe it's a voiceover. Like, there's all kinds of ways to fill in the gaps.
Totally.
Just do, like you said, be consistent. Do something.
Do something.
All right. Let me get off my soapbox with your soapbox talking about content. All right. So let's talk about the next section, which I always love. And I think it's fascinating too, because for you, more on the exit planning side and focusing on the exit side. Let's talk about the deal that got away. So this is the lessons of the lost deal. I enjoy this section. I'm sure it's like going to therapy and having to talk about some childhood stuff that you don't want to talk about anymore. But like, I feel like I torture brokers every single time when I get to this section, but I think there's value in it. I think it's helpful. Maybe it's some kind of, you know, release. I don't know. But let's talk about what comes to mind when you think of a deal that got away in terms of should have happened, could have happened, didn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Unload my trauma on you. No.
All right. The safe space. This is a safe space. It's okay. It's just you and I. Don't worry about it.
No, I think the one, there was one that I was working on a couple years ago now, and it was at the time the largest deal I had worked on. So I was really excited about that, right? It's always so exciting to work on the biggest deal you've ever done. And this wasn't someone that we had done exit planning with. It wasn't someone that we had worked with kind of before they got ready to sell. It was like, they were ready. The business was really good. There was a lot of great things about it. And we were working with a private equity firm that was ready to buy it, you know, at a premium multiple. It was looking really good all around. And the group that was going to buy it, they wanted to do a quality of earnings report, which is, you know, they have this third party accounting firm come in and review the financials very carefully and do this kind of audited, you know, quality of earnings situation. And so they were asking for all of this information that we had in the data room. And so I'm sending them the financials, getting them everything that they need. And they kept asking for data on the inventory, you know, inventory counts, like where it was located, because this particular business had multiple locations. So it was like, okay, where is the inventory? How much is there? What sells? You know, that sort of thing. And the seller tracked all of their inventory just in their point of sale kind of system. So they had a little bit of inventory tracking that we could share with them, but no real information on where the inventory was or like what was happening with it when it moved from location to location, like all of these different things. So we couldn't give them accurate inventory information. And that was kind of the main thing that kind of started our deal falling apart, is that they were trying to do this report to justify this higher multiple that they're planning to pay. And they can't, the quality of earnings report, like the accounting firm came back and they said, we can't complete this report, so we can't get this information. And so we're like, okay, what do we do now, right? We can't get them to the next stage if they don't have this information and it hasn't ever been tracked. So it's not like we can figure it out or, you know, go back in years past and find out what happened. So The buyer was suggesting then structuring the deal differently. And that obviously upset the seller, because now it's going to be more challenging in terms of, you know, they wanted a seller note and they wanted to change some of the earnout positioning and how that looked based on them not being able to get the information. And so we end up all in the room together, all the buyer and their advisors and us and the seller, and it gets pretty contentious. And then we, like, you know, we end up calming everybody down. We're like, okay, we're going to go away and we're going to think about it and see what we can find out. You know, try to take the edge off a little bit. And after that, we're chatting with the seller and trying to decide what he wants to do. And he had it in his mind that the business was worth a certain amount and it should be worth that. And that was all he was willing to accept. So it ended up falling apart. We couldn't get them to meet in the middle, which was too bad. And he was like, I'm going to keep it. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to fix it up and I'm going to come back and sell it later. And he did that, you know, he kept it and it was a great business. He was a young guy, you know, he's got time. So there was a lot that he could do with it. He built it up. I think he started another, you know, like related company to go with it. So he's doing quite well with it now, which is great. But the actual deal itself, we couldn't make it work. We couldn't make it work because we didn't have the data that we needed. And I hope, fingers crossed, that now he's tracking his inventory so that when he drives it again, they won't have this problem. But yeah, that was probably the worst.
Yeah. And again, going back to what we talked about early on with, you know, how business owners set themselves up for success or not, and what a buyer is going to want, where that's just like these things that could be avoided, but it's tough in the moment. You're not thinking about it, but the business doesn't need it. Feel like, you know, it's kind of that person who has a really messy desk, but they always claim that they know where they can find anything on it. Like if you clean their desk, like they won't be able to find anything. That's great. Unless somebody else sits at your desk and needs to do things, like then now it's a problem, which if you have a business and you plan on running that thing forever and, you know, never, you know, handing it off to someone else, and when you pass away, like the business will just shut down. That's fine. But then if you're actively trying to exit, then that's an issue.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Well, hopefully they learn the lesson. They're tracking their inventory. So,
I hope so.
Well, Jessica, I appreciate you being here on the show. Thank you for sharing all this. I'm excited for the after show. I want to get your take on the additional questions I always ask people and what may come up in the after show. For people tuning in, if they want to get a hold of you, they want to find out more about what you're doing, they love your educational side or your energy, your message, all that stuff. I know that people can find you. Your main website is exitwell.com or .ca, and it's WELLE. So it's exitwell with an E at the end, .ca. Also, you can find you on LinkedIn, Jessica Craig. Your link, your email will be in the show notes as well. I know that you're putting out content, obviously, maybe Facebook as well, depending on the person that you've hired. You might be in more locations by the time this goes live as well. Jessica, I appreciate you coming on the show and for what you're doing, you know, being a part of the IBBA in Canada and then, you know, also helping business owners and helping everyone that you're doing, you know, with all the speaking and educating you're doing. So thank you for that and for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And for everyone tuning in, please make sure to check out Jessica's stuff online, support her, get more of this message out, share this if you found value. Again, it's tough to help educate a lot of people, brokers, business owners, buyers, because it's really tough to know where to start. So hopefully if you found this valuable, you can share this out. Make sure to check out Jessica's links in the show notes. And until next time, stop hoping for deals and start growing your pipeline. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Business Broker Growth Show hosted by Jason Cutter. If today's episode helped you think differently about how to build your pipeline and grow your business, share it with another broker who's ready to make the shift from hoping for listings to engineering them. Join us again for the next episode of the Business Broker Growth Show, where brokers become trusted advisors.